Welcome to the Monogamous Marriage Podcast. We're Kate and Liam, married bisexuals a decade into our non-monogamous journey.
We've been having sex with our friends for 10 years, and we're still madly in love with each other.
We're the authors of the Monogamous Marriage blog, where we've been overthinking sex and love since 2016. This podcast is the place where we process our sexual adventures in real time.
We are not experts, and nothing we say should be mistaken for professional advice. This show contains mature language and sexual content, so if you're under 18, it isn't for you. But if you're a fellow overthinker and you're not freaked out by unfiltered conversation, you're going to feel right at home.
This is part two of our first ever two-part episode on the subject of separate dating. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I strongly recommend that you do that. Everything that we're about to say will make way more sense in the context of what came before it.
So to give a very quick recap, last time we had decided that Liam was going to go on a separate date, something he'd wanted for a long time that made me feel insecure. So where we left off last time, it was Valentine's Day Eve. I had been crying in bed beside Liam and felt like he was completely disconnected from me. He had no sympathy for my position, and I felt really alone and pretty brokenhearted. So I went down the hall and slept in the guest room. When I woke up on Valentine's Day alone, I really felt like we had a turning point that night before. And in my mind, everything had been mishandled. We had let this monster into our lives. That's how I was viewing non-monogamy at the time. And it was destroying us. And I felt like there was such a severe eroding of our connection and my sense of safety, because when I was saying no, when I was crying, when I was in the most obvious distress I've ever been in our relationship as we went through this week-long fight, I wasn't getting sympathy. I wasn't getting the care and the security I needed. I felt like Liam was just pushing his point and arguing his point and not caring for me, not keeping my heart safe. And it wasn't about the date anymore. It was about the fact that he was pushing to do something that was obviously hurting me, and he didn't seem to care that it was hurting me. And I felt like a marriage cannot exist under those circumstances anymore. So I got to a really low place.
And I woke up with a different perspective the next morning. So I guess while I had been lying in bed ruminating, and maybe even while I was sleeping, a new plan started to form in my mind. And that was really the result of kind of a conceptual breakthrough. So I began to see that, oh, even though I'm the one causing the pain, I could also be a source of comfort to Kate. So I thought the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go and hug her and hold her close and remind her how much I love her and how unimportant any date is relative to my connection with her. And I also remembered the concept of love languages. You know, a lot of my concern was over her perhaps disregard of mine, which is words of affirmation. And we won't go through the whole love languages thing now. You can look it up if you're interested. It's very fascinating. But one of those things that speaks most directly to Kate's heart is gifts. So I thought, this is Valentine's Day. I'm not going to accept defeat. Even though we've canceled our reservation for dinner, I'm going to rebook that, and I am going to go out and buy her a really great Valentine's gift, just because I wanted to show her that she meant so much to me, this thing that she was doubting, her place in my heart. I wanted to show her that that had not changed.
For me, the real gift was not the lovely watch you bought, but it was the fact that you said for the first time in that week that you were not going to go ahead with this date.
Right.
That you were going to put me first and that nothing was worth hurting me. So I had been dying to hear that for, I don't know, 7 days at this point. And on Valentine's Day, you said, that's it. I'm calling off the date. And that sense of, okay, now you see me. Now you see that I'm in pain and that this thing you want, even if it is a valid thing to want, is hurting me so much. Even if that's an invalid response, even if that's irrational and overly emotional, you saw me and understood that it was not worth inflicting this kind of pain for one date. So you backed down, and I was able to breathe for the first time. because right. I had really felt like I was in a corner and just being constantly bombarded with all of this logic about why it was reasonable and rational for you to want these things. And I didn't feel like I could breathe. So when you said, I'm calling it off, I kind of felt like a weight was lifted. So that night at dinner, we had our Valentine's date and there was a little relief and I could hold your hand and touch you for the first time in a little while and feel like, okay, maybe we can do the repair work and come back to the beautiful relationship we'd had before that I now felt was kind of cracked.
Yeah, so it was, for me, just a shift in perspective. So when a person like me is in the thick of defending the rightness of their cause, they aren't thinking about the pain that they're causing someone else. Because when I finally made the switch, when I turned off defense mode and went into compassion mode, it was very easy. Of course, I would never trade a date with someone else for all of the things you've brought into my life. That's just basic mathematics. But it means getting off of one track and onto another. And that cognitive flexibility had completely flown out the window for me.
So the next day we had our first appointment with Catherine from Expansive Connection, and it was really productive. So we were each able to tell our sides of the story and the conflict, and then she was able to give us some tools. So last time we mentioned the book Polysecure by Jessica Fern, and how when we began reading that book, it became really clear to me that I had an anxious attachment style. So for us, that tool was really powerful, I think.
So I know we mentioned attachment styles last time. It would probably be good right now to take a minute and just review them for people who have either never heard of the concept before or are just being reminded of it.
Sure. So I've got a couple of quick little descriptors from the Mind Body Green website. Mm-hmm. So secure attachment is described as the ability to form secure, loving relationships with others. A securely attached person can trust others and be trusted, love and accept love, and get close to others with relative ease. They're not afraid of intimacy, nor do they feel panicked when their partners need time or space away from them. They're able to depend on others without becoming totally dependent.
The secure attachment style, as all attachment styles, springs from the earliest experience of our childhood, and it's generally connected with our first attachment figures, which are our parents. If we grew up in a setting where our parents completely looked after our needs, where there was no insecurity around our care, we were going to grow up with a secure attachment style. And guess what? My mom was a phenomenally competent and present mother for me. I never wondered about that. So I have a secure attachment style. It's easy for me to connect. I don't deal with jealousy much. And there's a concept called relational object constancy, which is a concept we're all familiar with in children. That is, if you take the ball and hide it behind your back, a very, very young child will assume that the ball has disappeared from existence. And it's only later that they realize, oh, the ball's gone, but it still exists and it will come back. So in terms of relationships and attachment, someone with a secure attachment style like me can deal easily with the absence of their partner and, say, in the case of non-monogamy, with the engagement of their partner with someone else, fully trusting that that person is going to come back because that was their earliest experience of attachment. Their parents were always there for them when they needed them.
Yeah. So the second form of attachment is the anxious attachment style. And when I heard the description in Jessica Fern's book, I immediately identified with it. So here's the short version. Anxious attachment style is a form of insecure attachment marked by a deep fear of abandonment. Anxiously attached people tend to be very insecure about their relationships, often worrying that their partner will leave them, and thus always hungry for validation. So that was me. And if we trace that back to its origin, my mom was the daughter of an abusive bipolar man, and she carried the scars of that with her. She was a screamy, spanky, scary mom. And
let me just say, your mom is a lovely, lovely person, hardworking, but she was dealing with challenges she had not been equipped by her parents to deal with.
Right. So in my home, it was my job as the oldest of the six children to kind of mediate between my crazy siblings and my sometimes crazy mom. And that left deep scars in me. When I hear the deep fear of abandonment in that description, I feel that in my bones. So I'm the kind of person who has hustled my whole life to prove that I am worthy. So I was the straight A student who never did anything wrong, who was perfect in every way so that I wouldn't incur the wrath of my mother. And in school, I didn't really have many friends because I didn't think people actually liked me and wanted to spend time with me. In relationships, I bring that same insecurity. And I feel at all times like you love me for what I offer you, not for who I am. And so I work really hard. And generally, I'm pretty good at relationships.
And I can say that you're very, very good at relationships.
Yeah. So I put a lot into it because I'm constantly living with this fear that if I don't work hard, you're going to leave.
Right.
And that no doubt has been part of why I'm on my third marriage. I work and work and work, but I never believe that I'm good enough or that our relationship is secure and stable enough. And that's got to erode the relationship and make my partner feel like they can't do enough to show me their love. And it's hard. It's hard on lots of levels.
In the interest of completeness, we've talked about the secure attachment style and the anxious attachment style. We should probably just briefly cover off the third.
Right. So the third major one is avoidant attachment. And that's a form of insecure attachment style marked by a fear of intimacy. People with avoidant attachment style tend to have trouble getting close to others or trusting others in relationships. And relationships can make them feel suffocated. They typically maintain some distance from their partners or are largely emotionally unavailable in their relationships, preferring to be independent and relying on themselves. So that doesn't apply to either one of us,
right.
But that certainly might be something that our listeners would resonate with, and it might be helpful for them to understand that.
Yeah, so just to take it back, we were now introduced to the idea that we had two completely different attachment styles, and this wasn't just a pop psych kind of formulation. This was deeply resonant with us. And that's why you could actually come to me and say, you know what? A rock band of incredibly good-looking musicians has asked me to travel with them tomorrow to England for a week. And it's only for the purpose of fucking me after every show. And you know what? I would just say, wow, what an amazing experience. I hope you have a great time. Take some pictures if you can. And I can't wait to hear all about it when you're back. You, on the other hand, hear about one date with a person we know, and it completely takes you off the rails. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah. So the way this was helpful for us was instead of saying, oh, you are less jealous and I am more jealous, or you've done something wrong, you haven't reassured me enough, you haven't kept me safe enough, we were able to change the lens. So instead of pointing the finger at each other, we were able to understand that it's because we're fundamentally different. It's not each other's fault. It's our parents' fault.
Right. And that's kind of an interesting place to be in because I'm sitting there thinking, oh, so I would be going on a date with your enthusiastic support right now, not if it wasn't for you. It's like if it wasn't for your mother, or to take that chain back, if it wasn't for your mother's abusive father. So now we're talking about generations coming together in one simple issue that we're trying to decide on. And all these powerful, invisible forces are looming above us, making it almost impossible to have a meeting of the minds.
Right. And I was really beating myself up for feeling like a big hypocrite. You know, you had let me fall in love and I wanted to feel secure and safe enough to let you have that same experience. And I was hating on myself for not being able to do it. I really wanted to have that same generosity and support that you've shown me. And I just could not find a place in my body to give that to you.
Right. And that was really another great concept. So Catherine introduced us to the idea of attachment styles and directed us towards Jessica Fern's book. But she also said, here's a tool you can use in a situation like that. And it's the as if tool. That is to imagine yourself as if you had those feelings inside you. So I was thinking of myself with a secure attachment style, like, yeah, go do whatever you want. Why can't you let me do the same? But if I stopped to think, but what if that's not how I was raised? Then I would be having a very different experience and it would be easy to empathize with you. But what I had to do was think as if I was you, as if I had your formative experiences. And that was definitely a breakthrough for us.
Right. So that allowed us to talk about what we were experiencing without blaming. And that was very helpful. And an interesting thing happened. So once you backed down and you said you were going to cancel the date, and then we were given this tool to talk to each other about how we were feeling, where we could hear each other better, less feeling like it was an indictment, and more just with a curious desire to understand. Then I found myself relaxing into the idea of you going on this date again, because I felt like now it was my choice. Instead of being bullied into saying yes, instead of being kind of emotionally blackmailed, you know, at one point you said, you know what happens when people don't have their deep desires met? You know, they turn to resentment. And I thought, oh, great. So either I have to give this thing to you and maybe I feel resentment, or you are told no and you feel resentment. Either way, someone is going to have resentment, and this seems like a terrible situation. So once I felt like I was free to make the decision for myself again, and I wasn't being bullied into saying yes to something I didn't want, I felt like, okay, I think I can do it now.
So finally, the day before the date arrived, you were going away with your boys for a skiing getaway for 3 days, and I would have the house to myself. So you left. We were in a good place when you left, and you were even able to send me a text right before the date.
Yeah, so I was feeling a tiny bit anxious, but I was being distracted by the kids. But that day, knowing the date was about to happen, I tried to really tap into your love language. So as you had done for me on Valentine's Day and thinking about, well, what would Kate like? And you bought me a gift. I thought in that moment, what would make Liam feel good and supported here? And I know you said in the past that part of the key to this is my enthusiastic consent. So I sent you a note saying, I'm okay. I hope you have a good time. And I was, you know, mostly sincere. I wasn't fully okay, but I knew that's what you wanted to hear. So I tried to give that to you.
And I really appreciated it. That made a big difference. That took the last little bit of nervousness or anxiety out of my system just before Caitlin rang the bell.
So tell us all how it went. We're very curious.
Okay, so I have to ask you first, like, how frank do you want me to be?
Well, you know our policy here at the Monogamish Marriage. Full, brutal, total honesty.
Wow. Okay, here it goes. So we had arranged to meet at 5:30. I'm, of course, running around like crazy because I had decided in advance that the best way to do this date was not to meet her at a restaurant and be at the mercy of the wait staff and the kitchen's productivity level, but to have her over to our house. And you were fine with that. And what I thought was, I'll make her dinner and then we can be completely in control of our schedule, not have to factor in other things like traffic, and we'll have more time because this was a work night for her. She was going to have to get up early the next day to go to work. So when she arrived, I was just about ready. So she came in, we said our hellos, and everything went very smoothly from there. We ate together, had a great conversation, and that's part of the reason why I thought she would be the perfect candidate for this thing, was because we have a really great bond and the conversation is easy and we never have a shortage of things to talk about.
Okay, so this isn't the first time I've heard this story, but the first ouch point for me was you talking about how you had carefully researched a recipe and gone shopping to buy the ingredients and arranged the desserts on a tray with beautiful accents. And it occurred to me, oh, you've never made me dinner before.
Right. And that's a really good point. I actually realized that myself as I was putting the dinner together. I thought, oh, this is not good. Not what I'm doing for Caitlin, but the fact that I have never really done this for you. I've made simpler meals for you, but nothing researched and special like that. So I made a mental note that I have got to make sure I do this. That is a terrible lapse in my performance as a husband.
And this is not just about food. This is about one of my other love languages is acts of service.
Right.
And so I put a high value on feeding you, both emotionally and physically. And it's a very high thing for me in terms of like, here's what I offer.
Right.
I offer you sustenance. I offer you nourishment. I'm proud of the meals I make for you. And so we've talked a lot about love languages and how I'm not feeding your need for words of affirmation. Guess what? You've never fed my need for sustenance.
Right.
So yeah. To have you now do it for her the first time was extra ouchy.
Right. So this is a chance now for me to make up for a failing in the first part of this two-part episode, not properly owning up to my mistakes. So let me just declare now for our audience, that was a major oversight on my part. Guilty as charged.
Okay. So continue with your story.
Okay. So the idea was that we would have dinner and that we would have time for just cuddling after that, as bizarre as that might sound, that we could go to the sofa, because this was behind the whole concept for me that I didn't want to do the standard script in the lifestyle, which is we take off our clothes and now it's time to have sex. I wanted a more organic, more gradual transition from social connection to sexual connection. So I thought we can just go to the sofa and cuddle and touch each other and continue talking. And so that's what we did. So just checking in, still okay that I go into this level of detail?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay. So after doing that for a while, she said, I'm going to get changed and head upstairs, because the plan was if we decided that sex was going to happen, that we would do that in our guest room. So she changed and went upstairs. And a few minutes after that, I went to meet her. We then proceeded to have, I wasn't timing it, but I'm going to say an hour and a half of just really great sex. The thing that I had thought might be out there for me that this would work differently was happening. I've never had an hour or an hour and a half of sex in the lifestyle in a group sex situation. So everything seemed to flow and validate this idea that the separate dating approach might be better suited to how I'm wired as a person relating to another person.
Okay, so you went into far less detail here than you did with me the night of the date. So while you were on the date, I was starting to feel increasingly anxious. Mm-hmm. So I was skiing with my son, who is 22, and we got high together. It's legal in Canada. And I thought, okay, maybe this will help. And it actually made me more anxious. So then I contacted Scott and April and I said, can we have a Zoom call? I really just need to be distracted. So we talked for an hour and that helped a little bit. And then right after that, you and I had a FaceTime and I said, tell me as much as you want to tell me, because I'm sure you'll forget some of the details by tomorrow. So you told me everything. You told me the positions, you told me all the feelings. And the thing that stood out, I was okay with the sex. I was okay with the dinner even. I was okay with the snuggling. Everything was all right. But what hurt, what really stabbed actually, was when you described the feeling behind the sex. And you said that there was such intensity that you were trembling with desire and the sex was so connected and so intensely emotional and you were just so free to be creative and you were grabbing her and holding her close and pulling her into you. And you're describing all this and I am having flashbacks to the beginning of our relationship when we had sex like that.
Yeah. So my measure of great sex, and this is maybe unique to someone who is constantly in their head, who might be described as an overthinker, is that I am looking for a situation where I am not thinking about time. I am not thinking about my performance. I am just lost in the moment. And so I was able to get to that place with Caitlin, and it felt really great. And to me, I didn't compare it to how things are with us, because I was thinking, okay, this is one time with Caitlin. It's also very fresh and new, and it's great. But what we have, you know, I'm a person who keeps track of these things. We have sex about between 100 and 200 times a year. And the fact that our sex is so immensely satisfying that on many occasions, I am able to get to that place where I completely lose track of time cannot be compared to achieving that once with another person. But I get how that can be tough for you, because I'm in my own mind. I know for me that there's no comparison. For however great Caitlin is, that one occasion with her does not compare to the entire life that we've built together. Not just the practical things, but even on the sexual side. The fact that we have such a vibrant, creative, ever-expanding sex life 10 years into our relationship is mind-blowing and is something that is not easily threatened. But that's all in my mind, and you don't know that. You're just hearing about a fantastic experience.
Right. And the intensity that you described was something that we've talked about missing in our sexual relationship a few times in the past few years. And I said, like, I would like to have more connected sex with you. I want you to feel free. I want you to just abandon yourself in sex. And I feel like you're so in your head that we don't have that experience of abandon and intense connection anymore. So it was really hurtful to hear that you could get it with her, but also it felt kind of hopeless. Like, I'm now up against this shiny new thing that doesn't come with any baggage. And I don't know how to, I can't compete with that.
Oh, babe, I'm so sorry. I hate that I caused you any of that kind of pain. But this does show that difference. So I'm in my head, and in my head, there is no question that what we've built together over 10 years, Caitlin could not even begin to touch in our few minutes together, however great she was. But you have that relationship insecurity. It is bred into you, so to speak, and it's a deeply emotional thing. That's what I was continuing to bump up against, my inability to fully empathize with your position as a hurting human being. And it's embarrassing for me to say that.
Right. Well, and here we are. This is today, 2 weeks after the date.
Right.
And so the fact that I still can't talk about it without getting emotional is an indicator of how deeply impacted I was. And you know, to take it back to that anxious attachment thing, I feel like I need to be the best at everything for you in order to keep you.
Right.
Because if I am not number one in every scoring category, then you're going to leave me and find someone better. And that's what my attachment tells me every minute of every day. I have to be the best at everything or I'm going to lose you.
Right. And that really touches on a deeper level of this conflict and the emotions that are brought out for us. So in the second segment of this episode, we're going to dive into that deeper, because this issue has popped up many times in our relationship, and it's not always about separate dating. It was there from the very first months when we got together, and we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Because this is a special episode, we're only going to take one break and try to keep our announcements brief.
So let's first cover the upcoming events. We are going to be in Montana at Glacier National Park with our dear sexy friends, Naughty Jim, from May 7th to 11th for their outdoor adventure extravaganza. Then we're going to be at Podcastapalooza Color Pop in Palm Springs. That's from June 3rd to 6th. And this event is not yet sold out. So if you'd like to join us in Palm Springs in June, we would love to meet you there. Go to our website to find information and a link for registration. We are also going to be in Antigua with Room 77 for their Summer Bang 2022 extravaganza. Did I already say extravaganza? Anyway, that's going to be from July 29th to August 5th. I am going to be celebrating my birthday there, and that event is also not yet sold out. So if you want to come help sing happy birthday or give me some birthday spankings, we would love to see you in Antigua.
One other thing we want to mention is that we had a bit of trouble with our Patreon account, in that it turns out Patreon's kind of sex negative and was challenged by some of our material. So,
and we are very naughty.
Yeah, there's that too. So we have since recovered, but we have a new address. So if you're interested in supporting us, you know, we always do the blog and the podcast for free. But some people have said, no, we want to give back to you, and we really appreciate that. The address is patreon.com/Kate_and_Liam. So that's patreon.com/Kate and Liam. And now back to the Monogamish Marriage Podcast. You know, it's interesting. I didn't really see it right away, but this argument that we were having over separate dating was really just the latest incarnation of a long-standing disagreement that we've had. And I think it's worthwhile for us to dive into that a little bit now.
Sure.
This is a little tricky to talk about because what it has to do with is affairs that I had in my previous marriage. So I was married for 26 years to a wonderful human being who was not really right for me in any way. I hesitate to say that, but that's very much how it felt to me at the time. And so I told you about this in our very first lunch, that same lunch where you said, hey, I sleep with my girlfriend every now and then, and I want to continue doing that, is when I said I had two long-term affairs during my 26-year marriage. And I said that because I really wanted to be out of the secrets business. I wanted to get that on the table. And if you rejected me because of it, so be it. It was at an early stage. The harm would be minimal. But I did not want to embark on a new relationship where there was a secret that I was protecting my partner from. So I want to get that out on the table. But that wasn't really the problem. The problem was not the affairs. The problem was my perspective on them.
Right. So over the years, every time we talk about it, you continue to insist that you have no regrets about those affairs.
Right.
That you didn't do anything wrong because in the circumstances you were in, you felt like that was the best option. And I've been really uncomfortable with that. I've always wanted to hear you say that you regret what you did or that you wouldn't do it that way again or that you wish you had done something differently. Because if I don't hear you say that I think having affairs is wrong, then I am living with the belief that my husband could have an affair at any time because he can find a way to justify this to himself. And that feels really scary to me.
Right. So the way I always thought of it was that in a relationship where I feel I am getting none of the things I need, then I will always have an affair. 100 times out of 100, I will always have an affair. And that's because, and I think Catherine in our session did a good job of explaining this, there was going to be a betrayal. Either I was going to betray my own self and say, oh, life is about martyrdom and just doing what's required to be a good partner, a good citizen, or I'm going to betray my ex-wife. So there were no good options. There was just bad and slightly less bad. And I have to add that it was complicated by the fact that I had three young children and they were at various times struggling. And there was a lot of conflict in the house, particularly between my eldest son and my ex-wife. So it felt to me like simply leaving was not an option. I couldn't look at, for example, my youngest daughter and say, hey, Dad's got to look after his own needs, so he's going to be seeing you every second weekend and every Tuesday evening now. It should be awesome. I could not see myself saying that. So in that situation that I found myself, I believed that the best option was to pursue an affair and to pursue an affair in an ethical way. And I won't go into all the details, except to say that I said to both of the women that they had to assume that I was never leaving my marriage and that if that was the only reason they were getting involved was thinking that they would find a future partner, I had to make sure they knew that that was not going to happen. Because at that stage, I thought, I am in this marriage till death do us part.
And I get all that. I understand how difficult that situation was for you and that you made the best choice you could in that situation. But what I really wanted to hear you say at some point ever was that even though it was the best I could do, that it was still wrong.
Right.
I needed to hear that you believed it was wrong. And
why?
You've never been able to take, because if you don't believe that cheating on your wife is wrong, no matter the circumstances, then you can do it again. You can invent whatever kind of story you want to tell yourself about the deficiencies in our relationship and then justify to yourself that what you're doing is right, because that's what you did in your first marriage, and what's to prevent you from doing that with me? So if you go off on this date and you have, as it turned out, some of the best sex you've ever had and the most intense connection, and you're getting all of this ego-boosting stuff from this woman, you might come away from that saying, oh my God, That felt so good. I have been missing that so much with Kate. I didn't even realize how much I've been missing that. So you have this ability to explain to yourself that I had needs that were not being met, and therefore it was right for me to have an affair. You have a precedent of doing that. And so all it takes is a few things to add to your story to put together a narrative that says, I'm in that situation again. I have needs that are not being met by Kate, and I found someone else now who can meet those needs for me. And all of a sudden, I feel like the rug can be pulled out from under me very quickly.
Right. So the way I explained it to myself is that in a situation where I am not having any of my needs met, I will have an affair 100 times out of 100 times. But that does not describe our marriage. In a relationship, I don't even need 100% of my needs met. 50? Probably I'm incapable of having an affair at 50. And you're well above 50. You're in the 80, 90% zone. So I feel that there is no danger of me having an affair, of unraveling everything that we've built together, both our home and our finances, but also our social life, which is substantial now and something that we created from scratch from the beginning. So what people are seeing right now is exactly, again, if you haven't guessed it already, my moral self-certainty bumping up against Kate's relational insecurity.
Exactly. Yeah. So we've had this conversation over and over and over and over again. And that's the impasse we come to every time, that you are completely sure that you were right. And that completely shakes my security in our relationship. Because as much as you like to reassure me that I'm all of the things, I hear these stories you're telling me now after the date and feel like, well, obviously I'm not all the things. And so the very argument you're using to make me feel secure, which is you meet all my needs, or at least the majority of my needs, it's threatened by these new pieces of information I'm getting since the date, which is actually I'm not meeting some really significant needs for you. So anyway, it's not about this date. It's about my ongoing sense that you will always want for more, and that this separate dating thing is maybe just a slightly different incarnation of you having affairs on your wife, right? It's not that different. The urge that you had to look elsewhere to have your needs met with your ex, that's still what is happening here. The only difference is you told me about it and tried to get my permission, and I reluctantly gave it. But it's the same drive, I think, that same need in you for more and more and more pushed you back then to look for it elsewhere. And that's pushing you now to continue to look for it elsewhere in ways that are hurtful to the people you love.
Yeah, I unsurprisingly don't see it that way. So what I was seeing is that we had an impulse at the beginning of our relationship. So first of all, you with Melissa, but then as we discovered non-monogamy, you had an impulse, I had an impulse to say, what about enjoying more than just the two of us can give each other? So we kind of said by our actions and by our experience that that's not a bad thing to say. It's not an insult to your partner to say, I would like some things other than what you can provide.
Right. And the story we always told each other was that that was about augmenting our relationship and our sex life, right? So the things we do, whether it's, you know, a foursome with someone or you sending me to a hotel room to have sex with a single guy, all of that is about meeting some sort of sexual or social need that makes us better and stronger. But this doesn't feel the same because I have no enthusiasm for sending you off on these dates. It's kind of me grinning and bearing it in order to let you have a thing you want, but it doesn't augment our life. In fact, it makes me feel really shitty. And I feel like this doesn't really fit into what we originally envisioned, which was us making us better and stronger. I feel like this is actually you kind of tearing me up.
Right. So
I should correct that. It's not you doing something to me. It's you wanting something and me pushing myself to give it to you. And that's tearing me up.
Okay. I appreciate that distinction. You know, we could be drawn into now re-performing the entire debate in front of our podcasting audience. But I think we've done a good job of saying this is how that disagreement we had, that fault line in our relationship, showed up. And there were other ways besides, but separate dating was definitely the latest, and the earliest was my point of view on my past affairs. So we were having this debate about the past, about my feelings, about things that happened 15 years ago, when really the only issue was about the future. And that's why I was able to come to you yesterday, as it turned out, and say, I will never have an affair on you. You can say, I will never be allowed to have another separate date. One was already too many. It'll never happen again. And that does not tip the balance in favor of me feeling like I now have a grievance that justifies having an affair. I was able to look you in the eye and say, I will never have an affair, and address the only thing that mattered, which was the future.
And that was a big moment, because here we are 10 and a half years into our relationship, and that's the first time you've really said that in such a direct and convincing way. So that was a big step. And, you know, in one of our sessions with Catherine, she got you to finally admit that objectively what you did in your previous marriage was morally wrong. And that was also a big step. You had never said that before. So that has been a little bit reassuring.
And can I just jump in here? When I said that to Catherine, it was the easiest thing for me to say. I always knew that having affairs was morally wrong, but faced with the other option, which was completely denying my own happiness or ruining the lives of my children, I felt that it was the best of a set of bad options. But I think this is interesting, because I was able to say something that was meaningful to you and that I believed at the core of my soul. But because I had never phrased it that way, you walked around with a lot of uncertainty, and understandably. And it's amazing to me how important it was just to find the right way of expressing a belief. And this was also the case with me saying that I would never in the future have an affair on you. You could be less than I want, even less than you are now, and you wouldn't pass the threshold where I would have an affair. So I was able to say that, and it meant something to you, something that I'd always believed but had never put that way. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, and the process of you defending your moral position to the death is responsible for this disagreement and so many of our other disagreements, where all I want to hear is a simple reassurance, but you will argue for days about the rightness of your position rather than give that simple reassurance. And I feel like after 10 years of that, there's been a little bit of damage, a little bit of, I don't know how much I can trust, because I see you arguing and arguing for your side rather than just saying, you know what, I see that you're feeling threatened here by whatever it is. There have been different things over the years that you've pushed for that I haven't wanted. And backing down a little bit, instead of standing so firm in your position, maybe taking a step toward me and saying, I understand that you don't really want to do this, or I understand that you're feeling uncomfortable right now. I'm going to let it drop for a bit and we can talk about it later. Or can we find a middle ground? But you are so staid in your position that there is no movement, because for you to move toward me, it would mean that you were admitting defeat or admitting that maybe there was some wiggle room in your rightness. And so I feel like we've had these standoffs where they've gone on and on and on. And that really there was a simple solution, just each of us taking a step toward each other, but we just dig in, and that makes it really tricky. So all we got to is, as far as our reporting on the date, was the night of. So we had that FaceTime call, you explained everything that happened, and I felt shitty after.
Right.
So a couple days later, I came home, and you did a good job that weekend of reconnecting. So we went to a concert and we went out for dinner, although I had a hard time having sex. So it took me a couple more days after I got home for me to want to have sex with you. So the first night home, I didn't want you to touch me. And the second night, I think we went out for dinner with lifestyle friends, went to their house, and we got into discussing this, and it became an argument in front of them. You know, we were kind of asking them to be the mediators, and we came home from that and you turned me down. I actually offered sex the second night and you turned me down because of that conflict. So by the third night, we had had some time together. We had had a little a little bit of distance from this date and the raw feelings of it, and then we could have some reconnecting sex finally 3 days later.
But it wasn't like we had moved through a process of intense feeling becoming less intense and getting better and reaching resolution, because that peace that we felt that led us to be able to freely have sex soon disappeared. And that happened several times over the next couple of weeks. And I think always just with a very simple word or sentence or revelation. Do you remember how the first one happened?
Yeah. It was actually that first day when I came home. And I kind of thought what we should do, theoretically, is have sex the first night that we were back together to reconnect. But we started talking about your sexual experience with Caitlin. And one of the things, you know, I expressed that I was feeling like she was getting the sex that I had wanted, that intimacy and connection that we have talked about in the past having lost. So I've brought it to you in the past that I feel like we're not connected when we have sex, that it's kind of rote, right? We're just doing, you know, position one, two, three. Sometimes there's some variation, but I don't feel as connected as we used to. And so I've brought that to you and we haven't been able to resolve it. So when I heard you explaining what it was like with Caitlin, and I remembered, this is what I want. This is what I've been asking for. This kind of intense connection is what I've been missing between us. I had the conversation with you and I said, why is it that you could have it with her, but you can't have it with me? And your answer was really troubling. It was that you don't feel as free with me as you did with her because there's baggage. So, you know, I'm a Enneagram type one. I'm a perfectionist. I'm really critical. And I guess there have been times in the past, and there was one time in particular where you had a sexual desire and I didn't really want to do that thing. And so I never said that. No,
sorry.
I said, I can't do that.
You thought it's great. I just can't do it.
I didn't think it was great. I didn't say it was great. I said, I think, now this was maybe a year ago, I can't do that. You had given me a very specific script about what you wanted me to say and do, and it just didn't jive with me at all. I couldn't authentically say it. And so I found it frustrating because I want to be your everything. Like I want to, you know, I go out in the world of swinging and I can rock everybody's world, right? I sleep with people who are super enthusiastic about sleeping with me and I feel really good after, like, yes, that was awesome. They loved it. I loved it. But I come home to you and, you know, you ask me for this one thing. And I'm like, fuck, I can't do that thing. So I get really frustrated with myself because I want to be your everything. I want to bring all of this, you know, awesomeness that I have in the world of swinging into our bedroom and rock your world, right? But we do lots of amazing things. We have lots of kinky, outside of the box sex, but mm-hmm. that one thing you wanted, I couldn't access it in myself. And I was frustrated because I want to give you everything you want, but I also need to be true to who I am and feel in a sexual space like, yes, this is authentic to me. And yes, I'm aroused by this or at least okay with it. So yeah, so that, you know, you came to me with this fantasy. I couldn't make it work the first night. The second night, I thought, okay, I'm going to try again. I'm going to get high. I'm going to try and lose some of my inhibitions and do it. And we did. We did it.
Yes, absolutely.
But that one time was so damaging to your trust that you feel now like you can never be free with me. Like anytime you ask for something or try something new, there's a danger that I will say, no, I can't do that and turn you down. And so there was damage done to you by me.
Right.
And I don't know how to undo that. I can't go back in time and redo that night. And I can't reach into myself and change what turns me on and what turns me off.
Right.
So every time we have sex now, there is this baggage and you feel inhibited and I don't know how to change it because these things are in the past. And so you go into a situation with a new woman like Caitlin or anyone else that you date and you don't have that baggage, mm-hmm. right? There's no history with this person. So it can be free and, you know, you can be creative and uninhibited. And then how do you come home to me then? Like you're out there having this shiny new sex with the shiny new girl and it's all free and easy because there's no years of baggage with it. And then you come home to me and it's just like crusty old sex with the wife, right? Like,
which is not how I see it at all.
How can you possibly want that after you've had the freedom to go out and be your true self? And yeah, why would you want me? I wasn't going to cry this time.
What I think is happening there is, guess what? You can't do everything. And as we mentioned in the last episode with that idea, I don't know if people understood it when I said, you know, the kind of guy that would throw you around the bed, I can't do it. I am not going to be your guy. So that's okay with me. I don't think that you're going to say, whoa, I'm going to leave this guy and we're going to divide all our assets up so I can find someone who can throw me around the bed. My sort of inclination is that, hey, let's find a guy. And you've actually found a couple along the way who can do that. So I'm not concerned with having someone else pick up the slack where my game is just not very strong.
I think those are different things, though, because what I like are, you know, positions, moves. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about lacking with me is freedom.
Right.
And that is so much deeper than, oh, yeah, I like it when they throw me this way and throw my leg up that way. That's surface stuff. What you're saying that we don't have anymore is lack of inhibition and, yeah, the freedom to be comfortable and creative in the bedroom. That seems way more foundational to success and happiness than, you know, I like this move or that move.
I don't feel that way. I just feel like it's just another thing. If it's called freedom, well, I certainly don't have zero freedom with you because we have great sex. But if I don't feel the freedom to express a certain element of myself with you, I do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, I do not turn my back on all the amazing things you are. And I have to just say, in defense of our sex life, which is the third guest at this point in the discussion, I think our sex life is great. I think decrying a certain amount of routine coming into a long-term connection between two people is not realistic. Like, of course that's going to happen. And the question is, does that long-term habit still work for the person? So if someone masturbates for a long time, guess what? They come up with a system, and generally the system works really well. But my feeling about our sexual relationship is that it is at a very, very high level. And that measure that I use, am I transported out of my mind, out of time and space, into a place of infinite possibilities that I never want to end? I'm regularly in that place with you.
Yeah. And I think both of us would have been completely fine and happy with that if we hadn't had this experience. Right. So I guess this experience could have happened in a swinging situation, in a foursome situation where you found someone you really gelled with and had that kind of intensity. So I guess the comparison could have been made in lots of different settings. But I feel like we opened ourselves up to these comparisons that brought a dissatisfaction in that was not there before. So, you know, I talked about approaching you wanting more intensity, but it wasn't an urgent need for me. Like, I'm perfectly happy with our sex life too. And, you know, we could have gone through life happy with our sex life, feeling very lucky to have what we have. And I guess one of the dangers of this lifestyle, no matter how we structure it, is that it sets us up to make comparisons to others. And sometimes that's just fun and easy. Like, oh, did you see that crazy new trick Jay did with the pillowcase?
Yeah. I remember that trick very well.
Right. And, you know, and that doesn't threaten us, but sometimes the comparisons are harder. Like, not just the moves he did, but how that made me feel or how she made you feel. And so I guess this life is inherently dangerous because it lets us make those comparisons that other people don't make.
Or inherently strengthening so that you're able to see those things. And rather than the way it is in a common monogamous relationship where you're afraid of that scary world out there, we actually jump into the scary world and see those things and see Jay's pillowcase trick or some other new move and just say, you know what? It's okay. He's very cool. I'm not as cool as that, at least not with a pillowcase. And it's okay. It doesn't destabilize us. So I think that's one of the strengths of non-monogamy, but I get that you're also running a risk, and no one can guarantee their partner that they will never see something that doesn't change their belief in the value of their relationship.
So we continued to have these kind of ups and downs where I think for me, it was if I could not think about it and not talk about it, I was okay. I could get back to the place of us just being comfortable with each other. But every time we revisited the subject, it would kind of reopen the wound. So another thing that reopened it was 1 week after the date, we had a session with Catherine. And in that session, you were already pushing for another date.
And how did I do that?
Well, you were just saying the thing about if your partner has experienced something amazing, why wouldn't you want to have more of that for your partner? And I was asking that you kind of examine why you need this so much. Like, why is this so important that you would hurt me to get it? Because, you know, I had done the hard work of letting you go on one date, and it was really hard leading up to it, and it continued to be really hard after it. And I felt like, okay, I did the thing, but please don't ask me to do it again, right? I'm not recovered from the first time, and you're already starting to talk about a second time. And I said, can you just kind of examine where this comes from? Why do you need it so much when, in the face of my obvious distress, even after the thing happened, you're still asking for it again? And you said, I don't think I should have to go deep. Why are you pathologizing my desires? People just want things. And, you know, I had a good thing and I want more of a good thing. That's just normal. And I was like, can you just like give me a second to breathe? Like, I am not recovered yet from this first. And you're already arguing for a second date 1 week out. Like, how about just say, fucking thank you for doing this really, really hard thing. I see how much you're hurting, and I am so grateful that you're hurting for me. And then just like, let it go.
That was something that was an obvious deficiency on my part. If I had not expressed my thankfulness, my gratitude, then that was just wrong on my part.
So you did it for the first time in that session with Catherine 1 week after the date. You said thank you for the first time.
Yeah. And so that's part of my journey too, is to get off of being defensive. That is decades and decades of practice that I now have to reroute in my moral imagination. Just stop defending myself. And so even in this conversation, in a way, we're role-playing, although role-playing with some real intensity of emotion, but we're role-playing the conversation we had and the feelings that come up. But I have to now, in real time, when I'm feeling that incredible impulse to defend myself, I have to be able to put the brakes on and focus on our connection and our relationship and doing what's best for the person I care about more than anyone else in the world.
Another interesting thing that came out in the course of our conversations about this was that in your previous marriage, because you didn't really respect your wife, you just got everything you wanted. So it's a real shift for you to come into a relationship with someone you do ostensibly respect.
Which I really do.
And acknowledge that maybe you are not right all the time, and maybe you can't just have everything you want. So that was kind of a big revelation as well.
Right. A big revelation for who?
For you. That you had just taken everything you wanted in your previous marriage because you didn't really care about her or what she thought. You didn't really defer to her in anything because you were the boss. And now to have someone who you actually feel like, oh, once in a while, that chick actually has some good ideas. That's a shift for you.
Yeah. And it's more than once in a while, though. It's like a part of my daily life where I see we both put forward ideas. And I'm talking about mundane things like the route we should take to get to this place or that place, or how we should plan a vacation, or how we should arrange the furniture. And constantly I'm looking at my idea and your idea and going, oh, her idea is better than my idea.
But so, it always takes an argument to get there.
I don't think it always takes an argument. You're always going to notice those points over which we argue, and you're not going to notice the ones where I defer easily, because it's going to feel like, oh, of course, we're just doing the right thing. And so that's a big issue that many people have, which is we don't videotape and record every interaction we have. So we end up with impressions that cannot be backed up. And often they start with the word always. You always, I always, anyway. It's a problem because you have to arrive at some kind of consensus about which there is no independent verification. So we're working through those things, and they exist, and there isn't going to be a solution because we're not going to start filming everything. So we have to come to that place where we believe the best about each other and recognize the good things. And I think we're doing something that Catherine counseled us to do, which is pausing. So when you make a suggestion, I go, that's smart. I'll actually say, see what I'm doing there? we're doing it your way. I had a way, you had a way, your way was better. And I want you to stop and just recognize that for a second.
Right. So we had another positive turning point a little more than a week after the date where you finally said, you know, I was almost in tears in a restaurant as we talked about this again. And you said for the first time, okay, I'm dropping it. I'm not going to bring it up again until you do. And if you never bring it up, I will never bring it up. So basically you agreed to stop kind of pushing for or intellectually bullying me into doing this separate dating thing. And so just like it was helpful the first time, so when we were in the heat of the first battle and you finally backed down and said, okay, I'm going to cancel the date. And that freed me up to say, okay, give me a couple of days and then maybe I'll be able to let you have the date if I can just feel, you know, free for a little bit to make it feel like it's my own idea. You saying after the date, I'm not going to bring it up again. I'm not going to push for it anymore until you bring it up was a good way to get me to feel that same sense of relief for a little bit, just to have a minute to breathe and do some repair work. And so that was a good tactic.
Well, it was more than a tactic. It was a belief. I felt that it was the right thing. And it was, I think, another instance of me saying something that I had believed all along, but clearly had never expressed in a way that made sense to you. But it was easy for me to say, of course I'll never do it again. Of course I'm grateful for what you allow me to experience, to answer a question in my mind about whether that is a scenario that would work really well for me. But having answered that question, I now leave it with you.
Right. So that brings us to an interesting follow-up, which is the whole point of this, right from the beginning, was you needed to have independent verification that you were sexually attractive. And that's why you wanted to go on the date. So you went on the date and you had the verification. Everything was awesome. You performed. She responded. And so 2 weeks after that, we went to Tremblant with the Honey Spoons.
Right.
And you had your first opportunity to see if these were transferable feelings. So if your confidence that you got from your date could be transmuted into a foursome situation. So how did that work out?
At the risk of self-congratulating, it worked out exactly like I thought it would work out. I was able to, in that situation where we had a baseline, because we had been with that couple, we're saying the Honey Spoons, that's their name on Twitter, Honeyspoon_XL, I think is who they are. We know them by their real names, of course, but we had been with them at a club back in October, and it went very poorly for me. And so now we're seeing them with this experience behind me, and it was a big difference, so much so that the male half of the couple was able to say, wow, I really see the difference in you. It's a big deal. And so I think that made a very good experimental proof of, I think, what had been accomplished.
So do you feel like if you never get to have your separate dating experience again, that you at least got the affirmation you need and moving forward, you can kind of internalize that and take it with you into other situations?
Yes, because it's part of a journey. Like, nothing is as simple. If I'm presenting it as, hey, it's a very simple case. I need to prove my attractiveness. I've set up experimental conditions with a willing assistant named Caitlin to be able to prove that. And now the report has come in from the lab. And yep, it really works. And yes, I'm full of confidence. I was on a journey to be able to address my own inner critic, my own inner sense of my shortcomings, of my unattractiveness. And that was happening apace before I went out with Caitlin. But that might be considered the icing on the cake. So I feel like that really confirmed what had been happening in me already. So yes, I've said to you, I'm not going on another date until you bring it up to me and say that you would like me to do that. I am never going to mention it again. I am telling our entire podcast audience for what that's worth. That is my commitment. And so the ball is in your court.
Yeah. And I'm doing the work. Like, intellectually, I want to be the kind of confident woman who can say, we are unshakable. My husband will never find something better than me. Go out there in the world and search high and low. I feel completely sure that you will come back to me every time. I want to have that kind of confidence, but I don't. And I just want to pause and say that none of this negative feeling was ever directed toward Caitlin. So I don't think this could properly be called jealousy, because I don't worry about Caitlin taking you away. I don't feel negatively about her at all. This conflict is at its core about my insecurities. All of the bad feelings, all of the struggle I've had have been about us and about me. It's never been about Caitlin. I still really like her. She reached out to me after to make sure I was okay, and I really appreciated that. So she handled all of this very well, and there's just no bad feelings toward her.
Right.
So my work needs to be finding a place of acceptance within myself, really believing in my worth and what I have to offer, and internalizing your love for me. I need to work harder, clearly, on really believing that I am worthy so that I can get closer to feeling okay with this.
Right. And it's not just your job. It's my job too. I have to find ways, and I think we've seen examples of this in this conversation, of expressing the certainty that I have of my love and faithfulness to you in ways that are meaningful to you, in a way that you will hear. So I've got work to do so that we are both able to come together in a better place than we were clearly before.
So for now, the separate dating thing has been tabled temporarily. We'll revisit it. And in the meantime, we're going to do some work to repair and restructure both our relationship and our inner lives. I've found that PolySecure book very helpful. We're almost finished that. The sessions with Catherine have been really helpful. And I would encourage anyone out there who is going through some sort of relationship turmoil, whether it's related to non-monogamy or not, to seek out a good therapist. It can be invaluable to have someone who is outside of your conflict just look in from the bleachers and say, okay, here's what's going on, and just point out the things that maybe you're too close to see. So we're going to keep doing the work. I really want my body and my heart to catch up with my mind. So my mind is telling me this should be okay. And now my work is to get my guts on the same page and to convince my heart that I am worthy of love.
And can I make another suggestion?
Mm-hmm.
We have bared our souls here for the benefit of the audience. And I hope for ourselves that every time we talk about things that we get a little closer to a good place. But my recommendation is that we just not talk about this at all for, I don't know, what would you say, another month? Like, get back to the amazing connection we have, enjoying the things that we do together, and let our inner computers just work away in the background on what they need to. No one will be able to say about us, oh, they never talked it through. They never shared their real feelings and emotions. No one can say that. We've done it. And now we need to actually move past that phase and more into the building phase. And if we see a little even hint that we're going in that direction, we both have to give each other permission to say, stop right there. We are going to stay in a more harmonious place for now.
I agree. This has been going on seemingly nonstop for an entire month, and I am exhausted.
Yes. Well, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts so openly with the audience. But also for me, I think this is something that we'll be able to listen back on years from now. And it will be kind of a time capsule of where we were in the early part of 2022. So I think there's real value to what we've done, but it's time to say that that chapter is over.
All right. Close the book.
Okay. Baby, I love you. I love you so, so much.
I love you too. As always, we would love to hear from you. The best way to get in touch with us is to email us at themonogamishmarriage@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, themonogamishmarriage.com, or our Twitter account, @monogamish1, where we're active daily. Thanks for being with us. See you next time.